This is part 40 of the Reformation in England by J.H. Mel d'Aubigné, and this chapter is entitled The Pope Burns His Bull, November 1528. The king and a part of his people still adhered to the popedom, and so long as these bonds were not broken, the word of God could not have free course. But to induce England to renounce Rome, there must indeed be powerful motives, and these were not wanting. Wolsey had never given such pressing orders to any of Henry's ambassadors. The king, he wrote de Casale on the 1st of November 1528, commits this business to your prudence, dexterity, and fidelity, and I conjure you to employ all the powers of your genius, and even to surpass them. Be very sure that you have done nothing that, and can do nothing that will be more agreeable to the king, more desirable by me, and more useful and glorious for you and your family. De Casale possessed a tenacity which justified the cardinal's confidence, and an active, excitable mind. Trembling at the thought of seeing Rome lose England, he immediately requested an audience of Clement VII. "What," said he to the Pope, "just as it was proposed to go on with the divorce, your nuncio endeavours to dissuade the king. There is no hope that Catherine of Aragon will ever give an heir to the crown. Holy Father, there must be an end of this. Order Campeggio to place the decretal in His Majesty's hands." "What say you?" exclaimed the Pope. "I would gladly lose one of my fingers to recover it again, and you ask me to make it public? It would be my ruin." De Casale insisted. "We have a duty to perform," he said. "We remind you at this last hour of the perils threatening the relations which unite Rome and England. The crisis is at hand. We knock at your door. We cry. We urge. We entreat. We lay before you the present and future dangers which threaten the papacy. The world shall know that the king at least has fulfilled the duty of a devoted son of the church. If your holiness desires to keep England in St. Peter's fold, I repeat, now is the time. Now is the time." All these words, De Casale, unable to restrain his emotion, fell down. At these words, De Casale, unable to restrain his emotion, fell down at the Pope's feet and begged him to save the church in Great Britain. The Pope was moved. "Rise," said he, with marks of unwanted grief. "I grant you all that is in my power. I am willing to conform the judgment which the legates may think it their duty to pass, but I acquit myself of all responsibility as to the untold evils which this matter may bring with it. If the king, after having defended the faith and the church, desires to ruin both, on him alone will rest the responsibility of so great a disaster." Clement granted nothing. De Casale withdrew disheartened and feeling convinced that the pontiff was about to treat with Charles V. Wolsey desired to save the popedom, but the popedom resisted. Clement VII was about to lose that island which Gregory the Great had won with such difficulty. The Pope was in the most cruel position. The English envoy had hardly left the palace before the Emperor's ambassador entered breathing threats. The unhappy pontiff escaped the assaults of Henry only to be exposed to those of Charles. He was thrown backwards and forwards like a ball. "I shall assemble a general council," said the Emperor through his ambassador, "and if you are found to have infringed the canons of the church in any point, you shall be proceeded against with every rigour. Do not forget," added his agent in a low tone, "that your birth is illegitimate and consequently excludes you from the pontificate." The timid Clement, imagining that he saw the tiara falling from his head, swore to refuse Henry everything. "Alas," he said to one of his dearest confidants, "I repent in dust and ashes that I ever granted this decretal bull. If the King of England so earnestly desires it to be given him, certainly it cannot be merely to know its contents, but he is but too familiar with them. It is only to tie my hands in this matter of the divorce. I would rather die a thousand deaths." Clement, to calm his agitation, sent one of his ablest gentlemen of the bedchamber, Francis Campana, apparently to feed the king with fresh promises, but in reality to cut the only thread on which Henry's hopes still hung. "We embrace your majesty," wrote the Pope in a letter given to Campana, "with the paternal love your numerous merits deserve." Now Campana was sent to England to burn clandestinely the famous decretal. Clement concealed his blows by an embrace. Rome had granted many divorces not so well founded as that of Henry VIII. But a very different matter from a divorce was in question here. The Pope, desirous of upraising in Italy his shattered power, was about to sacrifice the Tudor and to prepare the triumph of the Reformation. Rome was separating herself from England. All Clement's fear was that Campana would arrive too late to burn the bull. He was soon reassured. A dead calm prevented the great matter from advancing. Campeggio, who took care to be in no hurry about his mission, gave himself up like a skilful diplomatist to his worldly tastes, and when he could not, due respect being had to the state of his legs, indulge in the chase of which he was very fond, he passed his time in gambling, to which he was much addicted. Respectable historians assert that he indulged in still more illicit pleasures, but this could not last forever, and the nuncio sought some new means of delay which offered itself in the most unexpected manner. One day an officer of the Queen presented to the Roman legate a brief of Julius II, bearing the same date as the Bull of Dispensation, signed too like that of the secretary Sigismund, and in which the Pope expressed himself in such a manner that Henry's objections fell of themselves. The Emperor, said Catherine's messenger, has discovered this brief among the papers of Puebla, the Spanish ambassador in England, at the time of the marriage. It is impossible to go on, said Campeggio to Wolsey. All your reasoning is now cut from under you. We must wait for fresh instructions. This was the cardinal's conclusion at every new incident, and the journey from London to the Vatican being very long, without reckoning on the Roman dilatoriness, the expedient was infallible. Thus there existed two acts of the same Pope signed on the same day, the one secret, the other public, in contradiction to each other. Henry determined to send a new mission to Rome, and proposed for this embassy one of the most accomplished gentlemen of the court, her cousin Sir Francis Bryan. With him was joined an Italian, Peter Vans, Henry's Latin secretary. "You will search all the registers of the time of Julius II," sent Wolsey to them. "You will study the handwriting of Secretary Sigismund, and you will attentively examine the ring of the fisherman used by that pontiff. Moreover, you will inform the Pope that it is proposed to set a certain grey friar named De Angelis in his place, to whom Charles would give the spiritual authority, reserving the temporal for himself. You will manage so that Clement takes alarm at the project, and you will then offer him a presidy guard of 2,000 men to protect him. You will ask whether, in case the Queen should desire to embrace a religious life, on condition of the King's doing the same, and Henry should yield to this wish, he could have the assurance that the Pope would afterwards release him from his vows. And finally, you will inquire whether, in case the Queen should refuse to enter a convent, the Pope would permit the King to have two wives, as we see in the Old Testament." This idea, which brought so much reproach on the Landgrave of Hesse, was not a new one. The honour of it belongs to a cardinal and legate of Rome, whatever Bousset may say. "Lastly," continued Wolsey, "as the Pope is of a timid disposition, you will not fail to season your remonstrances with threats. You, Peter, will take him aside and tell him that, as an Italian having more at heart than any one the glory of the Holy See, it is your duty to warn him that if he persists, the King, his realm, and many other princes will forever separate from the papacy." It was not on the mind of the Pope alone that it was necessary to act. The rumour that the Emperor and the King of France were treating together disturbed Henry. Wolsey had vainly tried to sound jubilee. These two priests tried craft against craft. Besides, the Frenchman was not always seasonably informed by his court, letters taking 10 days to come from Paris to London. Henry resolved to have a conference with the ambassador. "He began by speaking to him of his matter," says Jubilee, "and I promise you," he added, "that he needs no advocate. He understands the whole business so well." Henry next touched upon the wrongs of Francis I, recalling so many things that the envoy knew not what to say. "I pray you, Master Ambassador," said Henry in conclusion, "to beg the King, my brother, to give up a little of his amusements during a year only for the prompt dispatch of his affairs. Warn those whom it concerns." Having given this spur to the King of France, Henry turned his thoughts towards Rome. In truth, the fatal brief from Spain tormented him day and night, and the cardinal tortured his mind to find proofs of its non-authenticity. If he could do so, he could acquit the papacy of the charge of duplicity and accuse the emperor of forgery. At last he thought he had succeeded. "In the first place," he said to the king, The brief has the same date as the bull. Now, if the errors in the latter had been found out on the day it was drawn up, it would have been more natural to make another than to append a brief pointing out of the errors. What, the same Pope, the same day, at the petition of the same persons, give out two rescripts for one effect, one of which contradicts the other? Either the bull was good, and then why the brief? Or the bull was bad, and then why deceive princes by a worthless bull? Certain names are found in the brief incorrectly spelt, and these are faults which the pontifical secretary, whose accuracy is so well known, could not have committed. Lastly, no one in England ever heard mention of this brief, and yet it is here that it ought to be found. Henry charged Knight, his principal secretary, to join the other envoys with all speed, in order to prove to the Pope the suppositious character of the document. This important paper revived the irritation felt in England against Charles V, and it was resolved to come to extremities. Everyone discontented with Austria took refuge in London, particularly the Hungarians. The ambassador from Hungary proposed to Wolsey to adjudge the imperial crown of Germany to the Elector of Saxony or the Landgrave of Hesse, the two chiefs of Protestantism. Wolsey exclaimed in alarm, "It will be an inconvenience to Christendom, they are so Lutheran." But the Hungarian ambassador so satisfied him that in the end he did not find the matter quite so inconvenient. These schemes were prospering in London when suddenly a new metamorphosis took place under the eyes of Jubilee. The king, the cardinal, and the ministers appeared in strange consternation. Vincent de Casale had just arrived from Rome with a letter from his cousin, the prothonotary, informing Henry that the Pope, seeing the triumph of Charles V, the indecision of Francis I, the isolation of the King of England, and the distress of his cardinal, had flung himself into the arms of the Emperor. At Rome they went so far as to jest about Wolsey, and to say that since he could not be St. Peter, they would make him St. Paul. While they were ridiculing Wolsey at Rome and St. Germain's, they were joking about Henry. "I will make him get rid of the notions he has in his head," said Francis, and the Flemings, who were again sent out of the country, said as they left London that this year they would carry on the war so vigorously that it would be really a sight worth seeing. Besides these public griefs, Wolsey had his private ones. Anne Boleyn, who had already begun to use her influence on behalf of the despotic cardinal's victims, gave herself no rest until Cheney, a courtier, disgraced by Wolsey, had been restored to the king's favour. Anne even gave utterance to several biting sarcasms against the cardinal. "And the Duke of Norfolk and his party began to speak big," says Jubilee. At the moment when the Pope, scared by Charles V, was separating from England, Wolsey himself was tottering. Who shall uphold the papacy? After Wolsey, nobody. Rome was on the point of losing the power which for 9 centuries she had exercised in the bosom of this illustrious nation. The cardinal's anguish cannot be described. Unceasingly pursued by gloomy images, he saw Anne on the throne, causing the triumph of the Reformation. This nightmare was stifling him. "His Grace, the legate, is in great trouble," wrote the Bishop of Bayonne. "However, he is more cunning than they are." To still the tempest, Wolsey had only one resource left. This was to render Clement favourable to his master's designs. The crafty Campana, who had burnt the decretal, conjured him not to believe all the reports transmitted to him concerning Rome. "To satisfy the king," said he to the cardinal, "the Holy Father will, if necessary, descend from the pontifical throne." Wolsey therefore resolved to send to Rome a more energetic agent than Barnes, Bryan, or Knight, and cast his eyes on Gardiner. His courage began to revive when an unexpected event fanned once more his loftiest hopes. And the next chapter is called Wolsey Between Scylla and Charybdis. We need to look up Scylla and Charybdis, because I think that's something from classics, and I never studied classics.